I think we all know that everyone's journeys related to the pursuit of justice can look a little bit differently. And so there are some of us where a big event signifies the start of a true pursuit of justice in the world and in their lives. But then there are others of us who may be pursuing it consistently over time on a day-to-day basis, maybe without the fanfare. And so could each of you give a little bit of your story, whether there was a verse, a person, a book, a situation that started off your pursuit of justice, or whether it was something that happened over time, so that we can hear a little bit of your story?
So I think for me, it was, I think being a Korean American growing up in the United States of America, there's always the struggle of, you know, what does it mean to be really American and how do you fit in? And so I think growing up where my parents were immigrants, knowing the hardships they encountered, encountering racism, not on a regular basis, but every once in a while in my life growing up in Philadelphia, kind of really shaped my understanding of God's role in my family, God's role in my life. And I think there was one formative experience for me where I studied abroad in college. I went to Spain, and I remember there was this young African woman who was riding the subway, and these young Spaniards got on the subway and started graffitiing on the walls, "Get out of my country, black people," in Spanish. And so they got off the subway at the next stop, and I, you know, went up to this woman just to make sure she was okay. And there were two things that bothered me about what had happened. The first is that there was such a blatant racist incident right in front of me that happened. But the second thing that really bothered me was that no one on that train bothered to say anything to these Spaniards, to be, either call them out to say what you're doing is wrong, or even to come alongside this woman just to make sure that she was okay. And so that summer, I started working at, volunteering at the UN, doing some research, just trying to understand for someone who's an immigrant, like, what does it mean for them to have, you know, legal rights and protection? But I also started volunteering at an anti-racism organization called SOS Racismo. And I realized for someone like this woman, or even myself, when you live in a community in which you're the foreigner or in which you don't really belong, you don't just need legal rights and legal protection. What you need is a community to feel like you belong. And so I think for many of us, especially as we think about justice, I think it's those two angles that are really important. It's the legal, the systemic, the structural issues in which justice can flourish, but it's also about relationships, and it's about community, and it's about creating a sense of belonging that I think is really critical.
I like to tell people that I grew up in a bicultural family, even though we were all African American. It was very strange, actually. My mother, her side of the family, was very diverse. I mean, we had people from everywhere all the time on my mom's side of the family. You know, my mother loved heavy metal music. I know. She loved heavy metal music, you know. She had an affinity for white guys with beards. I mean, that was my mom growing up. And then my stepfather's side of the family was, all of his family lived in Baltimore City. And from my experience growing up, was a little more very black ethnocentric. That side of my family did not have any relationships with non-black people, other than people they worked with at the hospital who they just knew were racist. So this was my family growing up. So it was bicultural, unicolored bicultural is what it was. And the thing is that within that family, there was a side of my family where I felt like I belonged, and the other side of my family where I felt like I didn't belong. And I actually experienced a lot of racism within my family because of how I grew up. My stepfather's side of the family at times kept me out by pointing out how I was not black enough to be in the family. So when you grow up like that, you grow up with African-American people who can tell you, because of the way that you talk or things that you don't possess at the time, that you don't fit there. But then when you have to go out into the non-African-American world and also be told that you don't fit, you go into, like Jenny said, where do I belong? That's where Jesus found me at 13. I was the first Christian in my home. We had never gone to church, But I say that story to say that I know what it feels like to not be included. Don't you? Right? I mean, we all know that. And so for me, after, it's funny, from someone not being in church environment, okay, coming into a church environment, where this was even a thing, was like, we have to talk about this? You know, like, isn't this just a human? So just kind of eye-opening, actually, coming into a church environment. But, you know, we all know what it feels like to be that person. You've been at a dinner party before, and you're sitting at the table, and everybody who knows each other is talking to each other, and, you know, nobody talks to you, and you're like, I'm right here. I'm right here. And then the dinner ends and everybody's like, hey, it was great to be with you. You're like, you weren't with me. I was here and I was with myself, but we weren't together, right? Everybody knows what that feels like. And so because of that, there is no way anybody could convince me to keep other people out of anything. So that's why it matters to me.
I think it began for me as I became a bit more rooted and comfortable with my identity as a Korean American. I know Jenny spoke a little bit about it, but now I became a believer at the age of 18. But as I started studying more about my family and my family history and roots, I found out that my great-grandfather was one of the first people to say yes to Jesus in a small little village outside of the city called Pyongyang. Was so captivated by the gospel, he comes home and shares the good news with my great-grandmother. She says yes to Jesus, and our whole household comes to faith. But beyond that, I share that to say, you know, as crazy, because nowadays it's really easy for us to slam and dismiss all missions and all missions work. And I think we have to have the courage to examine some of the harm that it's done, but also to acknowledge that that God also worked within that as well. But as I started learning more about that story, I was really stunned that these crazy missionaries, that they were part of this Holy Spirit movement in Korea, where not only did they come bringing the Bible, but they came alongside local indigenous leaders. They helped build the first schools, the first hospitals, the first orphanages. They were out on the streets protesting an illegal occupation by, at that time, the Japanese Imperial Army. And that really captivated my attention. Something about, again, the message of the whole gospel. That really stirred me to be a bit more open to this message of the gospel. And when I spoke earlier about justice work bringing credibility to the gospel, that it's evangelism in itself, that's an example of, again, how that really fascinated a young person like myself.
I would say for me, it's been a series of life kind of experiences. Finding out my mother couldn't have babies in the hospital in Tennessee. She was born in 1931, so when she started having kids in the late 40s, that African-American women couldn't have babies in hospitals. Her telling me the story that, you know, the Ku Klux Klan burned a cross on their lawn. And being a young kid, not really knowing what that kind of meant, but knowing it's wrong. When I was 9 years old, we went from Pacoima, which is predominantly a black community, to Malibu, which is predominantly white and Jewish. And I remember being the only black kid on the playground and being called names and the things about me being pointed out, like I was fast and I could do this. So I just became more and more aware, middle school, and trying to date white girls. Back then it wasn't popular. It wasn't cool like it is now. And so there was a lot of rejection. And yeah, I'm still bitter about that. So I don't want to hear you guys whining about, it's so hard interracial dating, please, fool. But So, and then one of the big highlights was when I was in high school. Some of you know my story that I was dating a Jewish girl, and her mother basically looked me in the face and said, "You're the nicest guy she's ever brought home. You're probably the nicest guy she'll ever bring home, but you're black." And so then joining the kind of black consciousness movement back then, Public Enemy was big, you know what I mean? So we was fighting the power and all that. And just all these range, getting saved, like my brother Eugene at 18, world being turned upside down, but then being in predominantly white, fundamental, Baptistic, Reformed circles where it's those experiences. And then probably the two other experiences that shaped the most is when I was pastoring in the Antelope Valley, having God really speak to me about a matter of injustice for women in particular who had actually had abortions and are considering abortions, that the church I saw standing condemning it but not stepping in and giving the gospel to those who have done it or who are talking about it. And so God led me to partner with some people in the community to start a crisis, a Christian pregnancy center. And that was a matter of facilitating justice. And then the last thing was meeting Tom Stoll, whose son has autism. And just seeing him come to work with scars, getting beat up by his own son, and realizing that people with disabilities are actually the largest unreached people group in America, and how, like, that's marginalization and injustice, and God just saying, step into the mess. I invite you to come on in and practice justice here and see what that means. So those have been some of the things God used to bring me into this.
What I'm hearing from our panelists is that there is both a generational line of knowing about injustice or maybe getting displays of justice through our families, but then there's also this societal cultural context. So in our day and age, with media being so open, cycle after cycle, we are now more aware of a lot of injustices all the time, like I think both of you alluded to. So as Christians in our pursuit of justice and social justice, how can we as Christians and as a body of believers continue to persevere in a culture where it seems like it's a little bit futile? How can we persevere as a body of believers, even though our society, it seems like injustices and working for justice may seem futile?
I would encourage us that we have to start somewhere. And the reality is, and you guys know this, is that most of the stuff that we're exposed to, our hearts cannot take it 24/7. And I want to encourage you, you don't have to watch the news every day. I guarantee you, you'll find out what's going on. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think if we consume suffering 24/7, I think a couple of things happen. A, like VK is saying, we get overwhelmed. And you can feel like, well, what do I do? Nothing feels great, right? And then you lose perspective because everything becomes so large, and then we start to get all up in ourselves, like, I have to fix it, right? Rather than maybe asking the question, what could I do today to take one step towards something that's literally right in front of me? So just taking a small step towards something. But also, I think on the opposite end, what it has a tendency to do is to normalize the suffering in the world, where then all we do is scroll, right? My friend Tracy, she gives this great message. She says, you know, we're looking at Facebook and we see, oh my gosh, there was an earthquake, and you sit there for a couple of seconds and then you scroll. Ooh, cat video. Oh, look at that cat. Oh man, that's awesome. Scroll. Oh my gosh, there was a shooting at a club. Oh man. Scroll, right? Oh look, the president's doing something fun. Okay. then you scroll, you know, like, and so I think what happens is we, in this day and age, we actually have to take ownership about how much information is coming into us. I may be alone thinking about this, but I guarantee you, you will know what's going on. It will make its way to you, and you will know what to do. Trust the Spirit of God that He is leading you at all times. Okay? He is leading you at all times. And you addressing an injustice could be just being kind to your barista when your drink's not hot. You wanted it 108 degrees, and she made it 106, and you can tell. You know, I mean, it's like Eugene was saying earlier, these are actually the opportunities we're missing because we are overwhelmed by floods and shootings and, right? Because we're like, oh, I don't know what to do. Ask God to show you what is right in front of you today. I guarantee you He will show you. And at some level, I believe that will help us at least move forward so you know that you are a part of justice in the world, even in your neighborhood or even at the grocery store. I think that's what's key to remember.
I'll add a couple things to that. This is such an important question that I actually think that we can devote an entire conversation, an entire weekend on self-care. So statistically, not to discourage you too much, but statistically, there are some researchers that would say that about half of this room will no longer even be active worshipers of Jesus. So minus the conversation about justice, like half of this room by the latter stages of our life will no longer be serving or be involved in a church. Of the remaining half, there's some interesting research about what trauma or cynicism does to our spirits. So for my wife and I, one of our prayers is, we want to serve you for the remaining days of our lives, but we also want to do it with joy. Because I sense that there are people that are doing discipleship justice work, but there isn't a spirit of joy within our spirits. And again, it's just a hard conversation to have. And so, you know, a couple things come to mind that I think are really, really essential. Again, there's many things, but a couple that I would like to quickly highlight for the sake of time is that may we never replace the primary joy of worship in our lives. I think it's just really important. So even good things, when they're misguided or misrooted, can become dangerous, idolatrous things. I get a lot of flack for saying this, but I think for us as believers, justice work is beautiful, but when it's not grounded in the person and the kingdom of Jesus, for us as Christians, it could actually become idolatrous. So we actually worship Jesus or justice rather than Jesus. So it's really important that, I'll give you an example. I mean, I know a lot of folks who do justice work as Christians, but they eventually stop rooting themselves in a local church because in their minds they're justifying, well, I'm doing this work, that's my church, and it's not. Okay, so there's a distinction. The second thing that I would say is, you know, as Nikki was saying, is that you have to be very selfish about self-care. And again, sounds really unchristian, but I actually think no one is actually thinking about your self-care. So you have to be selfish about your self-care. You have to be the CEO of your own personal holistic health, body, mind, heart, emotions. And I tell people, be selfish. Why? Because we need you for the marathon. I know a lot of sprinters. I know some that last the 400 yards, some the 800 yards. But we all know that discipleship, which includes justice work, it's a marathon. And we need to be in it for the long, long haul. 25 years from now, when Ethnos is celebrating its 29-year or 30th anniversary, we need every single one of you here and then plus more. That, for me, is a sign of flourishing, if people are in it for the long haul. Third thing, really quickly, I would say, is learn to celebrate, even the small things. So again, I don't want to paint this broad stroke about Korean Americans or Asian Americans, but from what I know about Korean Asian culture, we don't celebrate too well, right? Am I right, Jenny?
We throw amazing parties. I don't know what you're talking about, okay. But
must be East Coast Koreans. Yeah. I don't know. In the West Coast, all we do is pray. No, but we don't celebrate as well. And I just realized that even we need to learn to celebrate the small things in our lives, but we also need to be the people that celebrate things in other people's lives. Cultivate that culture of celebration, because, man, there is such a heavy, oppressive, adversarial spirit sometimes that we need to not just remove weeds, we need to plant new beautiful things in our gardens.
When you actually look back at scripture and you read about the most amazing advocates in the Bible, and I think about, you know, Esther and Moses and Nehemiah, even some of the disciples, the one thing that always strikes me about what they were called to do in that moment and in that time is the fact that they were never called to do it alone. They always had a team. They always had individuals. They always had people that they could depend on for them to fulfill their calling, right? And so I think a lot of times for us, if God is breaking our heart for something, or we feel like God is calling us to do something, we feel alone in that calling. But what we don't know is that there are people around us, there are brothers and sisters in Christ within the local church who are actually right there with us, willing to cheer us on. Sometimes it requires us sharing about what God has placed in our hearts to do. And even if you don't find someone to co-labor with, that's fine, because someone else can encourage you in prayer and in, reading the word together and just sharing life together. And so I think for us, as we think about, doing the things that God has called us to do, that don't ever do it alone. Always do it in community, and always bring people along on the journey with you, because as much as you're learning and being formed and being shaped, you have the opportunity to shape and form others as you're sharing in the things with you. And so I would say that's one thing, just one encouragement. The other thing I would say is Gary Haugen, who's the founder of the International Justice Mission, said, there's so many things happening in the world that can break our hearts. And just being aware of those things won't change that situation necessarily, but nothing will change unless we become aware of what's broken in the world. So a lot of times being overwhelmed by things, you know, sometimes we don't know what to do, but simply being aware of it, finding out more information, following organizations or people that are working in that area, and getting involved, I think is really important. I've coined this term called the 4 A's of activism. So I think for us as followers of Jesus, we have to go from being apathetic to being aware, and then from being aware to being taking some kind of action, and then from taking some kind of action to actually advocating and addressing systemic issues. So if we can be on the trajectory of being apathetic to aware, to taking action, and then actually being an advocate, I think that's a good journey to follow.
I know a few of you have already touched on this aspect, but I'm aware that there may be some people in this room who have come here as the only representative of their church, or maybe they're not even a part of a church, who are seeking to have justice be real in our city in particular alone. So what types of encouragement can you have for those individuals who are here by themselves to get plugged in, to have people who are praying for them? And to build off on that, if we're in this room and we're in a community, how can we help support these people who are kind of on their own, and find them? And maybe it's talking to your neighbor, hint, hint. But can you give any advice to those people who may feel alone?
I believe one of the most important questions for us to ask or to answer, well, ask and answer, is what do I want? I say that because I think many times our first step is to define it, to define what is justice. And not only what is justice, but what is justice in my life? What does it look like? How do I know when I get there? How do I know that I'm working towards the right thing? Because I think sometimes we can have the idea of justice and then go looking for it and look for models other places and be like, oh, there it is. That's justice right there. That's what I need to do. But somebody else already did that, right? So for you, define what does God's call of justice look like in my life? What do I want it to look like? How do I want it to express itself? Because then we can focus, right? And this hits to some of the overwhelm, right? Then you don't have to have justice for 45 things. You can, right? You can't work towards justice for 45 causes and do it well. But what you can do is hone in on where is it that Jesus has given me this beautiful heart for justice, and can I focus my energies in that space or with those people? Because if you don't define what this work starts to look like for you, it starts to look like everybody else's work, and we don't need another copy. Somebody's already doing that. And the hardest part for us in the church, I believe, is that we just met and y'all are already like, I know when you don't want to say something and you look like that. we've become copyists instead of creationists. Everything we, not everything, that's a broad term. So many of the things that we do, we go looking for it out there somewhere. Wherever out there is. Well, what does our church need to look like? Let's go look and see what the hottest new church is doing, because obviously that's what God is blessing. So if he's doing it there, he's got to do it here. Those of you that work in Baltimore is unlike any other city. It's not just a city. And those of you that are church planters, you come to the city, you don't love the city, you love the people. The city is the people, right? But just remember that these people are different than any city you've ever been to. And if you decided to plant a church in Nashville, those people are totally different than the people in Baltimore, right? That's the beauty of the work. But I think when we define for what's right in front of me, how then do I best move forward? Because then you can start to invite people around you into it to say, hey, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. Can you help me? You know, what do you think about this? What's your expertise? Can you help me? Let's do it together. But I think it's really important for us in this work to say, what is it that I'm trying to do? Me. What am I trying to do? And how is it going to come and express itself through my life and the lives of the people around me? So it's important to define the work. What do you want?
Yeah, so I think I've talked with especially a lot of younger, you know, Asian American students, that a lot of them sometimes come up to me and say, oh, you know, you work at Roll Belief and you're doing all this stuff, and like I'm studying engineering and I feel called to justice, but how is that going to bear fruit when I'm going to be an engineer at some company? And so they're like, you know, do you think I should leave and like do something else? And I think sometimes we can get so caught up, like you were saying, Nikki, and just comparing ourselves or feeling like the work of justice means this specific, you know, road to travel. And I feel like God can use all of our gifts and whatever capacities to build the kingdom right here on earth in the places that God has called us to. And so for that, you know, young engineering student who wants to go overseas and, you know, work in impoverished communities, I say, no, like, look at the gifts that you have been given. And even if you're called to work at a private company, what can you do to build a culture that is based on kingdom values right where God has called you to? And it could mean within that company, you know, having conversations about the things that break your heart and letting people become aware of those things. It could mean that in your spare time you volunteer at a local organization that needs your help and your expertise. And so all of these things I think are really, really important is, you know, what are the gifts and the abilities God has given you in this moment, and how do you use those things in the communities that God has placed you in right here and now?
You know, I'll be honest, I'm not quite sure if I understood the question, and that's okay. I'm just going to answer a random question in my head. That's okay. I heard when people are here alone from their churches, and one of the questions that I occasionally get from folks that I think you said is, how do I help my churches come along when these issues are really, really important? And I would just say that I really think that's part of the ministry responsibility that we get to have. Because it feels at times like an uphill battle to encourage other people to be mindful of this vision of the whole gospel, that justice is not tertiary. And so a couple things come to mind is, sometimes I think it's so silly that we're trying to do the work of Christ, the work of the kingdom, and we're omitting the gifts, like spiritual gifts, like we're not praying. And again, sometimes, as I said earlier, it's the simple things that are really profound. And the reason why they're challenges is because we just take them for granted. They're just so simple. But many of us, I feel there have been times in my own life, I've been trying to do the work of Christ and I'm not praying. I'm not in God's word. Eventually it becomes about me, myself and I. And I devolve into this savior heroic complex, if you will. So it's a reminder that prayer is so important with all the groups, all the conversations, when you're meeting with your elders, when you're meeting with their pastors, to have conversations is so important. The other thing that I would say is that it's really, really tempting to wear our prophetic hats. To kind of go through our Elijah complex and say, am I the only one? And we become very self-righteous. But in doing so, we end up judging or dehumanizing even the people that we want to come along. And this is what I feel like is happening in our larger rhetoric in our country, where we're having really, really intense conversations about really, really intense things, but it's actually not with people in dinner tables or around fellowships, but it's basically across social media or across whatever it might be. And I find that you never, there's an interesting research going on about how many people change their minds based on these kinds of arguments. So think about if you were in leadership, if someone came to you with a spirit of righteousness or judgment, if that would sound captivating in some way. So this is why I think it's so important that we as Christians, that we understand, you know, Jenny has the four A's, because that was her GPA, and, you know, for...
It was not, just yeah. To clarify.
I have the four P's, which means passing. And so, so for me, I feel like the balance that we need is that we need to balance... It's personal, that we're embodying the things that we're talking about, right? That's so that we're not just panderers or not just people that are peddlers of the gospel, but we're embodying in our personal level, that it's practical, that we're living it out as well in tangible ways, but that we're also seeking to balance the prophetic and the pastoral as well. I've come to realize it's really tempting to wear your prophetic hat, go from place to place, drop bombs and leave, and you can do it because you have no relationship with the community that you're doing that with. This is why your work is so important. You know, I'm not saying that guest speakers shouldn't be honored in some way, but it's actually kind of easy to come, drop stuff, and then leave. But you're here, you're living in Baltimore. And so those four things, I think, especially as you try to encourage, help people with their reimagination of what the gospel can be, is, I think, what we need.
Yes. We want to give a few minutes if anyone has any questions for panelists. And if you got the question, you're going to have to show some courage and come up front here. I'll have the mic right up front here. But if you would like, you got open access to them. So
I also want to add, keep the question short, or Pastor Dan will have an arm.
Yeah,
of
the
love.
Arm of at our church, the arm of love might come out at any time. So
I'll just ask my question and sit down. I don't want the arm of love. So one of the things that happened to me not too long ago, I was sharing with some folks earlier, is I was giving, I'm a pastor of a church, predominantly white, surprise, surprise. I was giving a message called One Race, One Blood. And it was about how God created us all in his image and that there's no difference between us genetically. It's all just skin tone, melanin, and that. And there was an African-American gentleman who'd been coming to my church, and I pointed out that he and I could have a blood transfusion, and he got offended, I found out later, because I had singled him out, as opposed to giving the message that I was trying to give, that we're all the same. I singled him out because of his race and his color. And while I went and apologized to him, he never returned to my church. So I guess my question is, how do we as white brothers and sisters become aware of our privilege and check it so that we don't make those mistakes?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go a different angle on this. So, because I think some of this, I think it's been said by our two main speakers so far, and you're going to hear this in the breakouts. This is messy. And I have a word for ethnic minorities. We were grafted in by grace, by forgiveness. So one of the things that's really popular, as Pastor Cho said right now, is to sound off. And if we're not careful, we will do to white people, at least verbally, what has been done to ethnic minorities for decades. So what I would say to you, brother, is that you're gonna make mistakes. Nobody likes to make mistakes, but there's no condemnation for you. And that God is for you, and nothing's gonna separate you from the love of God in Christ Jesus. And I just wanna make sure that when we, like you said, when we go on this justice thing, that it doesn't turn into vengeance, and that we're still gospel saturated, and we make, you said something so powerful in Ephesians, that we bear with one another's weaknesses. You cannot do this work and then expect for people groups to get together that have never gotten together and not step on each other's toes and sin against each other. I wanna make you an absolute prophetic promise. You ready? If you do justice work, you will be sinned against. If you do not want to be sinned against, don't do justice work. And when you do justice work, you're going to need to forgive a lot of people, and a lot of people are going to need to forgive you. It's messy. And so I just want to invite us, that's the glory of the gospel, is that we get to get into this thing, do our best, make mistakes, learn from them, but be forgiven and be restored. That's really powerful.
Let me also add, white people, don't run from privilege. Now, hold on. I'm about to explain myself. I want you to think about the privilege you've been given as something that's man-made. Privilege is now the, you know, nastiest cuss word ever, right? As soon as you hear it, you're like, ah, no! Like, no, right? But check this out, okay? Your privilege was not given to you by God, right? You guys know that. But it was man-given. And so I want to encourage you that you need to see what has been given to you by the world in the tool, as a tool in the hands of the Spirit of Christ. Because I actually think it's a work of evil for those of you that have, those of you in majority culture that have that kind of a privilege, systemic privilege, to run from it, because then you can't use it to bless anybody. So think of it in the as a tool in the hands of Christ, for those of you particularly that do justice work, that you come into a situation with an awareness of what you represent, whether you have done anything or not. It just is. I don't like that that's true, but it just is. So when you go into a situation like that, just know that sometimes you have to go after people and it's okay. And that it actually might bless them. So I would just say that don't run from it. Ask Jesus how God can make you a person of grace, of empowerment, of learning, given what you represent in our country at any given time. I'm really sorry that happened to you, by the way. And also just know that sometimes people are just mad and it has nothing to do with their color. Right? And you work in a church long enough, you're like, you may have just got an angry brother, you know what I'm saying? And nothing to do with him being black. He just needed a hug. So I say that to say, just make sure you see the situation for what it was.
I'm sure there's other questions, and so please come up front, and Pastor Dan will hook you guys up. But I just want to address one thing, because I think the hard part is that no one monopolizes the absolute right answer. So it is messy, and I know we've said that. But having said that, I think there is a posture of humility that's encouraging. Your willingness to seek out after that person. Because in leadership, I think the great danger is to be abusive in our power. And so all of us, we wield influence, so we have to really steward that influence with Christ-like spirit, even if it's not a full reconciliation, right? We seek reconciliation. But I would say, is there awareness of the fact that you've offended or hurt? Is there maturity to apologize? And so for that reason, I think, you know, the panelists were saying it's an encouraging, even if it didn't necessarily come to the absolute fruition that we want. But I think there's also this importance about, are we willing to add new tools in our toolbox? So as a 48-year-old, I went through seminary many, many, many years ago, and I realized that the toolbox that I had 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, doesn't necessarily equip me for some of the complexities and challenges of ministry today. So I have to continually live into this definition of a disciple. Am I learning? And so to speak to maybe a question that you asked is, so as a pastor in Seattle, and also as I've traveled a little bit, you know, I've heard people use that sermon, and I agree with it theologically. Not that you've added to this, but an addendum that I hear that I think can be dangerous is that I've heard a lot of people, particularly folks that are white, say, but I don't see color, okay? And I know it comes, and I'm not saying that's you, but I know that it comes from a good place with good intent. But I think when you tell people, particularly those of color, saying, I don't see color, what you're basically saying is, I don't really see you. I don't see your experiences. I don't see your past. I don't see your story. And I always tell people, I think we should actually embrace and accentuate the diversity of our color, because it is with intent and sovereignty that God made us who we are. Okay? Now, I mean, we know that it's been twisted and abused to create hierarchy and significance, right? We know that, but then to go to the other extreme to say we don't see color, even when it's coming from a good place, I would say actually does more harm. Okay? So just as an FYI about that language.
Hi there, good afternoon. My name's Crystal, I live here in Baltimore. And I'm curious to know about any of your experiences either growing up in or being affiliated with a church that has a strong immigrant community, and how you've had conversations about reconciliation in a community maybe where there's been trauma. In my experience, I come from a Nigerian background, and my parents came at a young age. I was born in the States. But it's kind of hard to have a conversation about outreach and reconciliation with people outside of the community. I think get it intellectually, like we love people because Christ loved us, but in terms of like being intentional to reach out to the broader community, it can be kind of a hard lift. So just wanted to see if any of you have anything to share in that regard.
So I grew up in Northwest Philly in a Korean immigrant church, actually. And so when we started first going there back in the early 1980s, it was maybe like 30, 40 people. And now it's like one of the largest Korean American churches in Philadelphia. So it's, I don't know, around 4,000. And so it's interesting being and having been growing up in this Korean American church culture. If you ever see Kim's Convenience on Netflix, it's a new show. It talks about like what is this Korean, you know, church immigrant culture actually like, and it tropes on kind of stereotypes around like what that culture is actually like. And I think one of the greatest challenges, well, growing up in that culture, I learned that, you know, the Gospels focus on the four spiritual laws, and we're all about missions and evangelism and all of these things. And I think being in that community, it's created social comfort for an immigrant community that is trying to kind of make it and deal with the hardships of living as ethnic minorities in a predominant culture. So I think the church has played that role of creating social cohesion and resources and friendships, I think, in a community that has been, you know, somewhat marginalized. At the same time, I think my fear of a lot of immigrant churches is that because the churches have been used to provide social cohesion, that if these churches don't engage in the larger community, then I think sometimes the impact that these immigrant communities can have on the larger culture can be lost. And I say that because I think especially, and I would say coming as a Korean American community, you know, our desires for comfort and for wealth and to make it in this country is a predominant theme, I think, among a lot of immigrant communities. But at the same time, because we know what it feels like to be marginalized and to not feel like we fully belong, I feel like we can actually be the best bridge builders as well to actually reach out to communities that are consistently marginalized, that are consistently oppressed, and say, hey, I know exactly what it feels like. And even though right now I'm not, you know, we're still living and living out this journey, that there are intentional ways that we can actually be bridge builders and build relationships outside of our own ethnic communities. And so I think it is a challenge, I think, especially when I look at this church that I grew up in. There's an older generation, there's a younger generation of Korean Americans that knows what it feels like to grow up in this country. And I think that generation is really starting to ask the question, you know, what does it mean for me to be Korean American, but use that identity to actually impact the wider culture around me? But it's a constant struggle.
Any other panelists have any quick word on that question? We've got time for one quick more question here.
Hi, Salms. My name is Salms. We were talking earlier about doing justice unjustly, and one of the things that I think can come out of a conference is like a spark of wanting to do justice. So we come out of the gates guns blazing and we'll do ministries and start X, Y, and Z's without really taking the time to stop and listen. So can you talk a little bit practically about what does it look like to invite the people you want to serve to the table? Why is that important?
Yeah, I think it's a great, great conversation to have. You know, there's books and resources out there, and more conversations are happening because in the church, the capital C church, including the evangelical church, mainline church, the conversation of justice has become elevated, which is a good thing. I'm grateful for our spiritual fathers and mothers that have gone before us that kind of paved the way when there was no attention, no conversation about this. Things like this kind of conference didn't really exist many, many years ago. But because of that, I think out of our good intent, sometimes we're doing things in a sloppy way. We're doing things where we're commodifying it. We're doing things where we're turning people into projects a little bit. And I would just say, just having the conversation, are we exemplifying dignity? Are we exemplifying mutuality? Are we exemplifying integrity? So I'll give you an example. Because One Day's Wages does work around larger global development issues, water, maternal health, and child death, and it's really hard, painful stuff. And a sociologist, there's a few organizations, I'm not sure who owns it, but they began to term or coin this phrase, the pornification of the poor. And it's meant to be really provocative. And the reason why they began to articulate this was there was this unaccountable usage of photos and stories that clearly lacked any sort of dignity for the people that were being served. Sometimes you have these Christian organizations basically putting images of African kids on their t-shirts, basically saying, you know what, they signed a waiver. And I would say, I don't think they quite understood what they were doing when they signed waiver. And my question to them is, would you want your kids' photos to be on some random t-shirts in another country? Particularly in a very undignified perspective. So I'm grateful that more and more folks are beginning to have that conversation. And so, you know, earlier when I mentioned, you know, sometimes we reduce the poor into projects because we don't have this perspective of mutuality. And so that would be some examples, but for me, it's a commitment as an individual, as churches, as organizations to say, do we care about doing justice, but doing it in a way that we feel is also God-honoring and dignifying of the people that we serve, and always from a posture of humility? Yeah.
That's good. And I know some of you probably have more questions that you're curious about. I would encourage you, our panel, they're going to be here afterwards a little if you want to just directly ask them. We definitely want to honor you all the time. Let me, including Van Kim, if I give you one thing you want to say to the group here, not a 10-minute one thing, but like a quick one-sentence one thing, I would love to hear from each of the panelists.
I don't really have anything because I had the privilege of going a little over my time, so I'll just leave it at that.
Stay curious about everything and about everyone. Ask more questions, make less statements.
Bill Foster once said that charity is giving someone crumbs off your table, but justice is providing a place at the table. And I think for us, as followers of Jesus, we should be in the work of providing space at the table.
Mine would be deal with fear, because I think shame and guilt and embarrassment has killed its hundreds, but fear is killing its thousands in regards to justice work.
I think one thing that I'm learning from listening to all of you and all the conversations that I've had is that there are opportunities right already in our lives to start acting out justice for God's kingdom. And so keeping my eyes open, and I think the other thing is staying humble enough to pray that God would use us individually and corporately, as opposed to just selfishly doing whatever we think is what justice looks like. So
can we thank our panel for their wisdom and time?